The FBI says, hey, it's just one phone. What's the big deal? Apple says, yeah, no, it's not one phone either. Also, they'll see you in court. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, it is the 25th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I wasn't kidding about that what's the big deal thing. FBI Director James Comey was on Capitol Hill today testifying in front of the House Intelligence Committee. He talked about a bunch of stuff, of course, and also, of course, the Apple case came up. Here's part of what Comey said.
I'm trying to be cautious in answering because I'm not an expert, but what the experts have told me, and I'm sure this will be sorted out by the judge, is the code the judge has directed Apple to write works only on this one phone. And so the idea of it getting out in the wild and working on my phone or your phone, at least the experts tell me, is not a real thing. But again, I'm not an expert, and I do think that's something the judge is going to have to sort out.
As we all know, the judge is going to sort it out. Apple, in fact, filed its motion in the case today. Technically, a motion to vacate the magistrate's order that the company helped the FBI get into the iPhone in question, the one belonging to the San Bernardino shooter. We called our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, and asked her what the Apple filing had to say about Comey's whole no big deal thing.
Well, Apple and other technologists say that is a bit of a fairy tale. They say once that code is created, there's always a way to make it work on a different phone. And in fact, there are several other pending cases where lawmakers have already said that they would like to use a backdoor to get information in these cases that are not related to terrorism. So it's unlikely that one piece of code, one phone, would actually turn out to be the reality, at least in the opinion of Apple and its experts.
It's a 65-page filing, the document from Apple today. Lots in there, obviously. First Amendment stuff, Fifth Amendment stuff. Also this from Molly Wood again.
The big legal argument in this motion to vacate is basically that law enforcement is asking for something that it doesn't have the authority to request. And in fact, that Congress specifically prohibits law enforcement from asking companies, private companies, to create specific features, to require the design or adoption of new services just for aiding law enforcement. And that when Congress very recently had the opportunity to put new legislation into place that would give them that authority, they said no.
Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the Apple filing today. The hearing on this one, by the way, is on the 22nd of March, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, California time. Set your calendars. The crux of this whole thing, of course, is the encryption that Apple puts on the data that people keep on their phones. The New York Times reports today the company is trying to tighten that encryption even more. Apple's engineers are apparently already hard at work on that, which got us thinking about software engineers skilled in the ways of encryption and how they probably have their pick of jobs right now, and that this slice of tech is probably in quite the boom. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that one.
Perhaps a signal of how in-demand encryption engineers are came today from Apple. It hired the guy who designed Signal, the encryption messaging app endorsed by none other than Edward Snowden. And Matthew Green can tell you just how hot the encryption field is right now. He teaches encryption at Johns Hopkins University.
I've had a hard time trying to get students to come do summer research with me because they all get jobs at companies like Facebook and Google. They pretty much get snarfed up.
Snarfed up, and not just by tech firms, but by financial institutions, healthcare organizations, the auto industry, and many others. So woe is the employer trying to attract this narrow group of encryption specialists. Meet Joe Loomis, an employer in woe.
The issue that you struggle with is once you have talent that is interested in joining the organization, it's almost a catch-22 because you wonder why that talent hasn't been acquired by someone else.
And that's if you even get to that point, says Loomis, who's CEO of the startup Cyberspons. He says it takes him 6 to 9 months to find someone qualified.
I believe it's only going to get worse because encryption is extremely difficult to navigate.
But there's good news for Loomis. His business, which provides cybersecurity tools, is seeing increased demand, as are many other similar firms, says Rod Beckstrom, whose venture firm invests in cybersecurity companies.
The awareness of boards of directors and all C-level executives of the extreme importance of cybersecurity is only growing.
Beckstrom says companies are looking for any job seeker willing to take even some rudimentary cybersecurity training. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
All right, elsewhere in the unencrypted American economy. There's this. We led yesterday with a story about how consumers have been spending a lot of money on their homes of late and how that's been helping Lowe's and Home Depot to do quite nicely. Thank you very much. The upscale home furnishing store Restoration Hardware, however, isn't feeling that same love. The company has reported disappointing earnings for the quarter ended in January. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at what's up there.
Jeff Lessard is a serious Restoration Hardware shopper. He and his wife have recently dropped about $17,000 decorating their new home outside Boston with everything from couches to crushed velvet chairs.
The chairs are the petite Belgian slope arm chairs. Actually, they're a little bit small for the space. Wish we had purchased the larger ones.
That kind of customer was harder to come by in January, says Restoration Hardware. When investment portfolios shrank, consumers retrenched, hurting its quarterly results. Here's Telsey Advisory Group analyst Christina Fernandez.
I do think probably the month of January, there was some impact from the stock market volatility.
Restoration Hardware also cited weakness in areas affected by oil markets like Texas. But Fernandez says those factors don't seem to be hurting other home furnishing stores. She says Restoration Hardware's troubles seem to be more of its own making, like not having enough inventory lined up after launching new products.
Even if they get the orders, they can't recognize them as sales until the product gets delivered.
And retail consultant Carol Speakerman says Restoration Hardware is seeing growing competition from a cheaper online retailer.
It's a very promotional environment. Especially when you look at a competitor like Wayfair, for example, more or less the Amazon of that space.
Still, Speakerman says Restoration Hardware is making some interesting moves, like launching a modern collection, which might just need time to play out. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, another start low, end high session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Money is tight in higher education. Specifically, I'm thinking here at public colleges and universities. And nowhere, at least with schools of a certain size, is money tighter than at the University of California, Berkeley. The financial stresses on the UC system and state schools everywhere isn't a completely new phenomenon. But Berkeley is facing a $150 million structural deficit. That is, a budget gap that can't be zeroed out with one-off solutions. Nicholas Dirks is the chancellor at Berkeley, so the person responsible for fixing things. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
How did you find yourself in this hole, sir?
Well, I came here at a time when the state of California was doing much better economically. Proposition 30 had just passed. Unfortunately, some of the things that are necessary for universities to keep on going, like revenue, were heavily constrained. And expenses were going up, and we began to see over the course really of the second year and then this last year that I've been here growing indications that the deficit we have is not only getting larger, but is structural.
What are you going to do then? If you're going to look at this university from the ground up, as you say you are, what's on the table?
Well, actually, everything.
Let me try to nail you down a little bit
sure.
on that and ask you for some specifics. Are you going to cut, let's say, even though it's near and dear to your heart, you're a professor of anthropology, are you going to cut the anthropology department? Are you going to cut the journalism school, which, full disclosure, I attended for 6 months? I mean, how drastic are you going to be here? Because it does seem to me, and maybe some observers as well, that what the University of California, Berkeley, is doing right now is not fulfilling its basic mission.
Well, our basic mission is to conduct research at the very highest level and to provide the very best education. And we have been fulfilling that mission with extraordinary success. But we have to be realistic, too. You ask about anthropology. Are we going to cut a department like anthropology? No. But are we going to look at some of our smaller professional schools and ask whether or not they could work better together? Yeah, we're gonna ask all of those questions.
What about athletics? Which, you know, heaven forfend, you cut that, but they operated a deficit at Berkeley, and what are you going to do?
We're hoping to make an announcement in the next month or so about new arrangements we have with apparel providers and in multimedia rights that will bring considerably more revenue than we've been able to get in the past.
Did you open your Oakland Tribune yesterday or the San Francisco Chronicle and read about that donation to Stanford and just spit up your coffee a little bit?
Yes, I saw it. It's congratulations to them for an extraordinary gift.
But it must make you crazy that big private institutions in this country get money in the billions of dollars and the premier public research institutions of this land can't.
It is something we're going to change. You know, we brought in more money in fundraising last year than ever before. But of course, you know, Stanford, very successful fundraising operation, kudos to them. But they're also raising tuition every year. They're also having to do some of the things that we can't do. And I think we're going to have to be able to learn from and in some cases model ourselves on what the privates have done in order to be able to continue to compete with them as we do.
Do you suppose that if Berkeley's having these problems, and you are not by any means alone, but do you suppose that the business model of higher education in this country is broken?
Well, I don't think it's broken, but I do think this is a good time for all of us in higher education to think about some of the needed changes we may have to make.
Nicholas Dirks is the chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
Coaching, it turns out, is a billion-dollar-a-year business. We're not talking sports, but maybe you or somebody you know has a coach to help bring out the best performance possible at work and, by extension, in life. That industry has exploded in the past 10 years or so. Membership in the International Coach Federation has more than tripled, fueled not least by companies wanting to keep their best people happy and productive. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Noelle Theodosiou runs her own business in Boston. She's been working with a leadership coach for several years.
One thing at a time.
In today's session, her coach, Debbie Tyson, is prodding her to tackle a looming item on her to-do list.
How about resourcing the business? Does that seem like a good place to go next?
Yes, and I don't even know where to start with that.
Okay. We could start with a brain dump about what are all the things that you need support with.
Theodosiou works alone. She says it's easy to get bogged down by negative thoughts or spend too much time on certain tasks. She says that's where a coach helps.
I would attribute a lot of my success to the way coaching has changed my perspective and made some things easier and helped me to prioritize my emotional energy and my time.
It's not just entrepreneurs who are hiring coaches. The corporate sector is also fueling the industry's growth. It uses coaches to develop executives and promising up-and-comers. Magdalena Mook is CEO of the International Coach Federation. She says a decade ago,
it was almost a little bit of a quiet conversation. Oh, I'm not going to tell anybody that I have a coach because that means that I have a problem.
And now?
Having a coach is almost a badge of honor.
Because, she says, it means the organization is investing in your future. Now, the coaching industry isn't regulated. Coaches can train at a coaching institute or not at all. These days, a lot of universities teach coaching. Mook says that adds credibility to something that can still sound a bit woo-woo to some people.
It means that coaching can be a viable profession because there are degrees offered in that field.
There's certainly no shortage of aspiring coaches. Terry Maltbier is faculty director of the Columbia Coaching Program at Teachers College, Columbia University. The course fills up within days. Maltbier says during the first few years, trainee coaches would ditch their day jobs midway through the program.
Which was alarming to me because they had thought through the passion part of coaching. What they hadn't thought through is the business side of coaching.
And the business side can be tough. Coaches are self-employed. Executive coaches can charge hundreds of dollars an hour. Still, according to the International Coach Federation's latest figures, the average coach salary in the US is about $50,000 a year. Completing Columbia's coaching certificate program costs $19,000. Maltbier says that qualification gives coaches an edge in a competitive landscape.
The demand for coaching is increasing compared to, like, say, when I entered this field in 2006. However, the supply of coaches, both trained and untrained, is actually higher than that.
there are a lot of coaches looking for work. Noelle Theodosiou found her coach through a recommendation. And she says the right coach can boost your performance.
It's one thing to change your behavior. It's another thing to see that the result of all your effort translates into good outcomes.
Her business has tripled in the last 2.5 years. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I was dressed to Pizza Hut code and simultaneously dressed to repel any woman I may have come across.
Even pizza delivery guys need love, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 212 points today, 1.2%, 16,697 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 39 points, 0.8%, 4582 there. The S&P 500 rose 21 points, about 1.1%. 1951 was the number. Berkshire Hathaway is going to report earnings after the bell tomorrow. And Warren Buffett plans to post his annual letter to shareholders at 8 a.m. Eastern on Sunday. That's like Christmas and the Oscars and pretty much everything good wrapped up in a bow for people on Wall Street. Berkshire shares clicked up 1.2% today, too. And get this, I love to bring this number out every now and then because it's so amazing. $198,889 per share of Berkshire Hathaway A-shares. Amazing. One big stock holding of Berkshire American Express charged up 1.3%. Today we told you about the problems at Restoration Hardware. That stock slid 25%. Williams-Sonoma, which also owns Pottery Barn and West Elm, went along for the ride, sank 6%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Even as the scramble is on to find a vaccine effective against the Zika virus, a report out today in the journal Science says researchers have made some progress in finding a treatment for Ebola using antibodies found in a survivor of an Ebola outbreak back in 1995. It's not a vaccine, but it is a treatment anyway. There is still no licensed Ebola vaccine, despite a couple of them getting fast-tracked during the outbreak last year. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Michelle Aloy looked into what happened with some of those vaccine trials.
In a nondescript office park outside Atlanta, researchers at Emory University's Hope Clinic are running tests on blood and plasma. The samples come from people who received an experimental Ebola vaccine, which made it to a final trial in West Africa. But it arrived a little late.
We were unable to have enough cases, which is a good thing.
Emory's Dr. Mark Mulligan helped lead some of the early human studies of this vaccine, now licensed to the big British drug company GlaxoSmithKline.
We're glad that the cases went down, but for the vaccine, we didn't get to answer that all-important final question, does it protect?
This vaccine is one of two that actually made it to a final large-scale trial during the outbreak. The other did show early evidence that it protects against Ebola. Just a few weeks ago, the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi, announced it would pay American drug company Merck $5 million for that promising vaccine. Merck's Dr. Julie Gerberding, speaking on a panel at the World Economic Forum, said the deal would help bring the vaccine through final licensure. But even that's not expected until sometime next year. As Gerberding explains,
good science takes time.
Emory's Dr. Mark Mulligan says other vaccines can still get licensed without another outbreak. The university's researchers are still monitoring those who were part of their trial. Mulligan says the lab is about to start work on another vaccine trial, a Johnson & Johnson product that just squeaked into West Africa for early studies.
The upcoming clinical trials that we'll do in humans will be important to establish the safety of the vaccines against Ebola and that they produce an immune response.
To prove that final question, does it protect? Mulligan points to what's called the animal rule. That means the vaccine will need to show it protected animals from infection, since it wouldn't be ethical to expose humans to Ebola. Dr. Ann Schuchat is deputy director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It ran vaccine trials in Sierra Leone, one of the three countries hit hardest in the outbreak. Schuchat says the animal rule is necessary for fighting diseases like Ebola.
They might or might not be perfect predictors of what happens in humans, but for things that are quite rare or, you know, things like bioterrorist agents, the animal studies can be very important.
Back at Emory, a different division is leading a team of 10 labs studying the blood of the 4 Ebola patients treated at Emory's hospital. These researchers are trying to find antibodies and immune cells, the things in the body that help a person fight a disease.
So our interest is both from the side of, okay, let's make something useful that can be given to people.
Carl Davis is a research associate at the Emory Vaccine Center.
Also, let's understand what happens early on in a viral infection so we can maybe understand how to try to trigger those same kinds of responses to get longer-lasting vaccines.
Davis says their studies are mostly in animal trials right now. Still, why keep putting all of this effort into developing new Ebola vaccines if there was one that seemed to work pretty well, the one being developed by drug company Merck? One reason, that vaccine is specific to Ebola Zaire, the strand that caused the outbreak. But there are others, Ebola Reston, Ebola Sudan. There's also Marburg, a virus similar to Ebola. If one of those causes the next outbreak, doctors might need a different vaccine to help stop it. In Atlanta, I'm Michelle Alloy for Marketplace.
We've got an every now and then series going on this program where we ask you all for stories about how something you bought, that most basic exchange of money for thing, led to something surprising. We call it the transaction, and today's installment comes from listener Marcos Menendez.
Around 1997, I was working as a pizza delivery guy for Pizza Hut. Not a bad college gig if you have your own car and can stand your car smelling like tomato paste all the time. It was a regular Friday night, and I was giving my last delivery in the west side of El Paso, Texas. I jumped in my untrustworthy 1985 Honda CRX and drove off. I reached the house, walked up the driveway, and rung the doorbell. I was dressed to Pizza Hut code and simultaneously dressed to repel any woman I may have come across. The door opens, and a 7-year-old kid grabs the pizza and runs off. I hear the soft laughter of a young lady approaching the hallway door. As the girl turns her head to greet me, and I see her, time slows down. I mean, time comes to a halt. You can cue Gary Wright's Dreamweaver song. Stunned by her beauty and smile. I was speechless. She extended her hand to pay me. I collected the cash and looked down to put the cash in my stylish Pizza Hut fanny pack. I turned and walked back to my car. I thought to myself, man, I wish I had a girlfriend like her. 2 weeks later, my boss and Pizza Hut manager was getting married. His fiancée, who also worked at Pizza Hut, said, "You should come to our wedding. I have a friend. Her name is Maru. You delivered a pizza to her home in Belvedere Street, and she wants to meet you." I went to the wedding and formally met the same girl I had delivered that pizza to. Maru and I have been married now for 15 years and have 2 great kids. In this life, there are no coincidences, just related transactions.
Related transactions. Nice line, huh? They live in Miami now, Marcos and Maru, and the kids do. This is one of those things, this series, that only works if you send in your stories. Transactions about anything. Hit marketplace.org to send them to. Final note on the way out, which I'm going to preface by saying there's another GOP debate tonight at which immigration reform will likely come up, thus leading to frontrunner Donald Trump likely talking once again about his wall along the Mexican border and how he's going to get Mexico to pay for it. Nobody has yet been able to pin Mr. Trump down on exactly how he's going to get them to pay for it, but Fusion anchor Jorge Ramos did ask former Mexican President Vicente Fox what he thought of the idea.
I declare... I'm not going to pay for that wall. He should pay for it. He's got the money.
There you go. .212 was the number to the upside on the Dow today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 39.8%. The S&P 500 rose 21 points, 1.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.